South American countries, basically when the broad-spectrum insecticides came in, Stethrus disappeared. And it's interesting now, as we're getting to more physiologically selective compounds, I'm getting a lot more requests for reprints, because Stethrus is starting to appear back into the New Zealand, Australian, and some of the, especially in India, I get a lot of requests. Okay, Stethrus, basically the problem with that was that there was a lot of bronzing. Like I said, the thresholds were high enough that you had some injury. Growers were willing to tolerate that at the time because we didn't have terribly effective miticides. There were miticides that, like Kelthane and Plictran, that they had gotten resistance to, and there really was no alternative. The industry wasn't churning out a bunch of new miticides every year, so that was the only game in town, and they were mostly processing at that time, too. Which processing apples, you really don't care about the russeting on the surface of the fruit or color like that. You could tolerate a bit of damage, and the industry in Pennsylvania and the Mid-Atlantic at that time was about 70 or 80% processing. Fresh market guys, they were a lot more sensitive to it. So it fit really well into the type of programs that we had. And what was the success? Well, from Ed Rajah and Larry got some numbers together back a number of years ago, and they basically figured from the late to early 80s to the 1990s that it reduced miticide use by about 50% in Pennsylvania, just in Pennsylvania alone. And this is really true of all the other acreage in the Mid-Atlantic as well. Everybody pretty much adopted it. And it saved growers about a little over $1 million a year, about $20 million over that 15-year period. And the really striking thing was that this was in a time period when you're using Kelthane at 4 to 5 pounds per acre in Plictran. They saved 2.2 million pounds of miticides, what the estimate was. So it was a very successful program. Well, I did my work on selective insecticides when I was with Larry, but I went to work for Roman Haas for a while, the evil chemical industry, but I was working on selective insecticides. When I came back, I started, and when I was working with them, I was doing a lot of work in apple orchards, we started to see a kind of a mysterious decline in numbers of Stethrus, probably about the mid-90s. And we started seeing some increases in some of the other predators, such as the phytoseed mites. And this is some old pictures of Larry and I actually in the lab there, but we did a lot of assays both when I was there and when I was at Roman Haas, looking at the selective insecticides on Stethrus. And we think we've kind of linked, and this was published in one of those papers there too, we found that a lot of these so-called selective insecticides, the reduced risk pesticides, are actually very toxic to Stethrus, much more so than the azophos methyl and some of the other products that we kind of conditioned with alderomethyl sprays. The neonicotinoids, imidacloprid especially, was murder on them. A lot of the chitin synthesis inhibitor IGRs, Novaluron being one now, is very strongly ovicidal to them, and a lot of other countries saw this as well. It also kills them from the larval to the pupal mold. Juvenile hormone analogs, same thing. These so-called selective compounds were very, very disruptive to Stethrus and some of the new miticides that came along. And also we had a switch in the industry from away from processing apples with big old trees to little small fresh market apples that didn't have the tolerance for the damage anymore. So it was actually about 4 years ago when we started noticing that Stethrus was disappearing and growers were nuking all the orchards again with miticides, that we started looking for another predator. And I was doing a research in a number of orchards we called reduced risk from a RAMP grant that we had. And we were seeing increased numbers of phytoseeds. And we had one grower that basically used to rely on Stethrus, but now was relying, he wasn't spraying anything. We found high numbers of what we thought were Amblyopsis fallacious, a phytoseed. And what it turned out to be is actually we had T. pyrae move in from New York and New England for the first time. There had been multiple surveys in the past and they never found it. And T. pyrae has basically replaced Stethrus because it's pretty much resistant to all these so-called reduced risk insecticides. It tolerates the neonicotinoids and all the IGRs, and actually is a much more effective predator in the long run than what Stethrus was. These are some of the surveys looking at T. pyrae. It was a bit of a surprise. We thought we were too hot, kind of at the southern range of it. But T. pyrae now, looks like it changed the fonts a little bit. But basically, growers in about 2005 were putting on about 2,200 pounds of miticide AI on the 22,000 or 23,000 acres of apples in Pennsylvania. And this was costing growers about $700,000 to $800,000 a year. And they were putting on 35,000 gallons of dormant oil, which is getting really expensive, and you really don't want going out in the environment. And by switching to T. pyrae, which we've got going now, that cost is down to only $50,000 a year, and we're saving most of that miticide and the oil. The point we're at right now is that we have T. pyrae very well established as a predator in there. We only need one of those to every 10 pest mites, but they do their best job early in the spring or late in the fall. They don't handle the summer heat. So when they get out of control, say two spotted mites move up into the trees, we still rely on Stethrus to kind of move in there. Now Stethrus is kind of a secondary role. It's supplementing our biological control with the phytoseeds, but it's still out there and important. And then we're making plans to get away from some of these other toxic IGRs that are impacting. So the reason that T. pyrae became so important in Pennsylvania was basically that we had the selection pressure in apples of about 45, 50 years of euthymium. That basically, and we did it, we applied it in an ecologically selective way, which other countries didn't do, and we build up the resistance. And the pattern resistance was that we were able to use glutathione for 55 years or whatever because cowlie moth didn't get resistance to it. So the main pest we're trying to knock out is cowlie moth, and we can still use glutathione for it, but the secondary pest got resistance. We needed the biological control to take them out, and we had a resistant biological control organism. And then this alderone middle plays a very strong part. When we didn't have physiologically selected compounds, we used toxic compounds in a selective manner. Now we have selective compounds. We need to figure out how selective they are, but they're changing the whole system. So that's about a 40-year picture of what the program was going on in Pennsylvania. Thank you.
Pictured here is a typical agricultural monoculture. As you can see, it's just the crop plant in rows. It's really the only plant species that's present, just bare ground in between the rows. And so this is going to be a pretty hostile environment for many types of natural enemies. And what some of the earliest agroecologists noticed is that whereas you see quite typically these really explosive and really devastating pest outbreaks in these simple agricultural systems, in more diverse natural systems, it's very uncommon for herbivore densities to be very, very high. So this, what was thought then and suggested is that maybe what we need to do in agricultural systems is restore some of the diversity of natural systems. This view is typified by this quote by Pimentel. So the idea is it's a lack of species diversity in these communities that we need to then, that's causing these pest problems, and restoring diversity might help to ameliorate some of these problems. So something like providing floral resources, some other resources that would draw in a more diverse and abundant community of natural enemies. So with this viewpoint then, what we're saying is that what we want is greater biodiversity or more species present in these agricultural systems. This is kind of the common view, I think, in agroecology. But if you've been reading the predator-prey literature for the last few years, you might get quite a different opinion of whether or not biodiversity is going to be a good thing, whether greater diversity is.
Thank you guys for coming today. We talked about earlier about the importance of role models, and I think for me as someone who maybe doesn't have as much teaching experience as we've seen today, I have had the privilege of working with Dr. Tom Turpin and being able to really jump in there and tie my theater in and really learn about how to engage the students in a way that's exciting for them and that helps to spark meaning for them. And so some of the things that we're going to be looking at today are things that we've used in the classroom, that Tom has used in his classroom, and that some of presenters in our department use in outreach activities and things like that, that we think that really help to spark meaning in our students and really help to create an interest in entomology. And we're also going to be talking about how to tie in other disciplines, use entomology not only to teach entomological concepts, but to use entomology to teach any other concepts in any other discipline. So like I said, our activities, they're going to be employed in undergraduate courses in the Department of Entomology at Purdue. But we also do a lot of outreach in our department. So we use a lot of these in our outreach programs for not only elementary students, but also secondary students. Some of the goals that we keep in mind when we're working on working with these activities, we're really hoping to aid in developing a meeting. Not only meaning, but understanding, a deep understanding of entomological concepts through hands-on inquiry, things that we've been talking about all day today, activities that are oriented to those, that type of learning and interactiveness. And we're also looking to introduce entomological concepts in a format that are interdisciplinary, or to use insects to tie them into other disciplines. The activities specifically that we're going to be looking at today are the roach weight pull. We're going to be looking at cricket jump, roach speed, biological concept cartoons, and a roach in a box. And they're all pretty straightforward, but I think that when our students get to do them, they have a lot of fun with them. I've got a lot of pictures, so you guys are going to get to see a lot of fun things that we do with these. And these are some of the main ones that we use. By no means is this everything that we do in the department. So for the road to weight pull, as you can see here, what the students do is they pull a sled. Basically, we kind of hitch them to a sled. And the sled is gradually loaded with more and more students until the sled is so heavy that it can't be pulled by the students anymore. So as you can see in the picture, we have starting off with one person sitting on the sled, and then we've got two people sitting on the sled, and it's in the middle of the hallway, in the middle of Smith Hall during the semester, so everybody gets to watch you, and it's actually quite entertaining. An elaboration that we do on this also, and we've done this with younger children, especially this elaboration where we actually bring the roaches in and we make a little mini sled for them and hitch up a petri dish to the cockroach and then add pennies. One at a time we add pennies until the roach can, it's so heavy that the roach is no longer able to pull the petri dish. And the concept that we're really hoping to instill in the students is that roaches can pull, relative to their size, roaches can pull a great amount of weight than we can as humans. And we tell them, you know, that roaches pull about 13 to 14 times their body weight. And whenever we do this with young children and whenever we do this in the classroom, they actually will weigh the pennies and they'll weigh the roach. And they math is tied in a lot to this activity, and they come up with how much was the roach able to pull in the end, and so on and so forth. And you know, our students, when we do this with our students, don't necessarily some of the females don't necessarily want to give out their weights, so you know, general estimates, things like that. Whenever we were working on this, for the most part we were able to see that on average the students were only able to pull a sled that was loaded with two students. And that's about 2.5. That was about 2.5 times their body weight. I did include a picture of someone pulling three students. This was only occurred one time, so I thought it was pretty interesting to put it in there. As you can see, he's straining a little bit, but he was able to do it. And looking at the elaboration activity, the roaches are able to pull normally anywhere between 30. This one was able to pull 34 pennies in the petri dish. And sometimes they need a little bit of prodding. You've got to remind them that they're supposed to be moving, you know. But the students really get into it. It's really fun. You can really see that they're by actually participating in this activity and becoming the roach themselves per se. You can see that they're really starting to understand the concept a little bit more, and in a fun way. And I think being from, you know, theater. For myself, I think that part of introducing our students to science, oftentimes students think of science as it's not as fun. It's from a textbook. We stand and, you know, as a teacher, I stand in front of the class and lecture to my students. But this is the side of science that we want them to see, that it's fun, that it's engaging, that it's exciting. And in order to actually learn the science, I think it needs to be exciting. There needs to be some level of excitement there. And this is what we're seeing in our students in these activities. The cricket jump activity, another really fun one, right? We're talking about active engagement. I think this is about as active as you can get, literally speaking. The students are just jump from a standing position that's marked on the floor. The length of the jump is measured and recorded. Again, there's a strong math tie to that. And they're able to do, with younger kids, we work with graphing, and I think it's important as someone that's currently in science education to try and tie these things into the standards quite frequently, because teachers, younger teachers, or teachers of elementary and secondary students, you know, that's a big concern for them. So, you know, being able to tie in the other disciplines, tie in the graphing, things like that, helps them out, and they really appreciate that. The concepts that we're wanting them to look out here is the distance that a cricket can jump and how much greater it is than we can jump as humans, especially, you know, from a standing position, and that crickets can jump about 20 to 30 times their body length. And they were able to jump pretty far, okay? I'm going to give them some credit. Our students did really, really well, not 20 to 30 times their body length well, but as you can see in the picture here, he got really into it. The students were able to jump about 1 to 1.5 times their body length, so some of them were able to jump. I think the longest one that we had was just over 7 feet from standing. I think that's pretty good. But once again, it's getting the students off their feet, out of the classrooms, participating, you know, in the activity to really develop meaning and understanding for the concept and to be able to remember it later. It's so much easier to remember it whenever you can say, I remember that because I did that activity in class and I had so much fun, and you know, and it helps them to develop that meaning. Then we also looked at roach speed. This one was a little bit different because we were mainly focused on not necessarily an entomological concept that we're looking at, but this one ties math in very strongly. So we wanted the students to calculate the speed of a roach with a limited amount of materials. And I actually allowed my students to use more materials than is normally given. Normally they're given a piece of paper, and they cannot use a ruler, and they cannot use a tape measure, and they're told to how fast can your roach move. And we use Madagascar roaches because American roaches would be a little bit tricky, so because they're pretty fast. So what we're looking at here intercurricularly, we're looking at non-standard units of measurement and how they can be effective tools of measuring length or distance. So this can be a great tie-in for a unit on non-standard units of measurement. And I have examples of our students using a number of things. They had their pieces of paper. We know that younger kids might not know this, but we know that a piece of paper is 8.5 by 11 inches, and most of them use their watches. If there was a clock on the wall, then they use the second hand to time it. We had students that used the paper, the length of a pencil. We had students that used the squares on the floor for 12 by 12. We had students who used their feet, literally like this is a foot sort of thing. And we also, as you'll see here, we had students who used paper clips, which we've actually used quite frequently with younger students as a really effective form of measurement. And basically they were able to come up with all kinds of non-standard forms of measurement, things that I really hadn't thought of that I thought were pretty neat. And although this one doesn't directly relate to an entomological concept, I think that it's important for teachers to realize that we don't just have to be teaching entomology in our classrooms, that it's about bringing entomology in anywhere in the classroom. Then we looked at the biological concept cartoons. These are so much fun. The students, toward the end of the semester, toward the middle of the semester, wherever you are, they're given a list of biological concepts, and based on their knowledge of the concept that is given to them, they have to design a cartoon that illustrates that specific concept and properly illustrates that entomological concept. And in example A, this is looking at how the concept that the housefly was the first insect to become resistant to the insecticide DDT. So that's DDT in their cups there that they're drinking, okay? And these are so much fun to do, and they're so interesting, and the students really come up with some great ideas. In example B, it's honeybees lose their stinger when they sting and die as a result. So this one, it says old and wrinkly. So this, obviously, this honeybee is a conscientious objector. Okay, so not participating there. But the students were really able to complete a cartoon that scientifically and creatively represented their biological concept. And you can go further with this and have them do revisions and final drafts and things like this. These are some of the sketches that our students did that we thought were really clever and really showed that they were able to take that concept and put it into their own words and in their own how they think of that concept themselves. Roach in a box is the next one. In this activity, we give the students a piece of paper, we give the students a paper clip, and we tell them that their only task is to, using those two items, to come up with a container that the roach will not be able to escape from. They can work in teams, and this is a great one for problem-solving skills. But the concept basically is to just demonstrate that roaches are extremely agile and are pretty much able to escape anything. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing about this lesson is the students really try to make the most perfect box, and they're making walls, and they're folding it in, and they're, you know, something that really looks sturdy and something that really looks like it would be effective. And when they put their roach in there, they pretty much everybody figured out that it can escape every single time. And granted, leaving them in there overnight, the roach can chew its way through, but not thinking in terms of that. I actually had one student that was able to come up with a box that the roach was not